Hi everyone, and welcome to the third episode of the Well and Wild podcast. I hope that all the UK listeners had an amazing bank holiday weekend and you're looking forward to a nice little short week this week. So the guest I've got on for this week's episode is super interesting. His name is JB and he's from Perth in Western Australia. We met on the yoga teacher training course that we both went on in March, the course run by Stefan, who I had on for our very first episode. So if you haven't listened to that one, make sure you check it out after this one. JB has a really interesting background, which he dives into further during the episode. But essentially, he left school at 17 and followed his passion for tech and working with computers. And he spent many years in the corporate world before ultimately starting his own company, an animal welfare tech company called Pet Rescue, which helps find homes for rescue animals all over Australia. And Pet Rescue has actually now rehomed over 500,000 pets, which is absolutely incredible. And I really, really enjoyed the conversation that we had, and I hope you enjoy it too. So welcome, JB. How are you?
Well, I'm really good, thanks.
Good. And how did you find settling back into Perth after our crazy month in Bali?
I've got to be honest, it was a bit of a challenge coming back to the real world, coming back to work and, you know, the day-to-day challenges of a house and pets and, you know, things like that. But leaving the yoga bubble. Mm-hmm. But I think it's been really nice sort of to keep up that yoga since we've been back, and particularly, as I said, to start teaching, which has been an amazing opportunity to start a weekly class and soon starting up a few more classes as well each week. So that's been a really good opportunity and a nice way to keep that yoga influence in my life, which has been great.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely felt it a little bit when I came back to London and got on the train and stuff. I was like, oh, coming back to the real world with a bit of a thud.
Yeah, but absolutely.
All good. Okay, cool. So it would be great to hear a bit more about your story. So how you went from, I guess, growing up in Busselton to moving to the city and like your years in corporate to then founding your company. It'd be great to hear a bit more about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, look, it's a big story. I've had a lot of jobs. I've lived in a lot of places all around Australia, mainly on the West Coast, and I spent a few years in Melbourne as well. But I started out my career as a humble printer technician. Back when I was 17, I think I was in my final year of high school, as we call it over here. And I was about halfway through. I was a good student. I was, you know, an A student most of the time. Was on the student council and involved in a lot of things in the school. But I kind of got a little bit bored and I didn't have great aspirations to go to university and do that sort of further education. And an opportunity came up to pursue one of my two passions, which was, you know, working with electronics and working with computers. And they were the kind of the two things that really excited me when I was younger. And this job came up working on printers, and I have a strong mechanical background. My dad's a mechanic, so I learned a lot from him, and it seemed like a great job. So I quit school, and I've never actually been back. I haven't got my year 12 certificate or HSC certificate. I haven't been to university or anything since.
Just to give context to the people in the UK, so what age was that you quit school?
That was 17.
Okay, nice. So yeah, we would have been doing A-levels then.
Yeah, that's right. And yeah, I felt at the time maybe it was a mistake to not complete that. And over the years since, I've continued to wonder now and then if it was a mistake or not. And so far, it hasn't really held me back. So, you know, I'm 40 this year, and I've got a lot of achievements under my belt. So feeling pretty good about that decision. So yeah, started off fixing printers and very soon moved into working on Windows computers. Windows 95 came out around about that time. And I found I had just a natural aptitude for working with computers. It comes very easily for me. And I'm just good at it. I can sit in front of the computer and fix most problems. And it's something I really enjoy as well. So I felt really lucky to find a job that I was good at, I enjoyed doing, and I didn't need a degree to chase that career path. And so from that point, working in printers, working in Windows 95, but in networking, I started working for Alcoa in Australia. It's a large aluminum mining and manufacturing company. So I worked at one of their aluminum refineries in Western Australia for a couple of years. Around about 2000, I guess, I moved to Melbourne. I had a job opportunity over there, which was quite exciting. And so I took the plunge, moved to Melbourne, and took on an IT manager job for a direct marketing agency, which turned out to be another one of those really great decisions. Working in that role, I got to meet some amazing people, do some amazing work with some very big clients. And crucially, it's when I met my co-founder, one of the two co-founders, two other co-founders of Pet Rescue, Vicky. And Vicky was working at this company as an account manager. And Vicky and I got along really well. And we, a couple of years later, or a year or two later, Vicky and my partner at the time started Pet Rescue. So it was a really lovely coincidence that I met Vicky at this company, and that led us to starting Pet Rescue together. And yeah, so since then, I've worked in a bunch of different jobs. I started a web hosting company in there. That was my first foray into entrepreneurship. I find it difficult to identify as an entrepreneur. I feel like it's a bit of a cliche kind of title these days, and maybe a little bit funky, but I've won a few awards over the years for nice. Entrepreneurship, and I keep starting businesses, so I guess that's kind of accurate.
No, I think that's amazing. I think that's a really cool story. And I love how you've kind of, these opportunities have just sprung up and you've kind of seized them. Because I think a lot of people, the universe sends them opportunities, but they don't kind of necessarily have the confidence to just take that leap. Something I just wanted to pick up on that I thought was really interesting was about how you met your co-founder. Because I personally have like had different business ideas over the years, and I even met someone from uni, and like we had the same work ethic and everything, and we did try to start a business together, but it just turned out that we couldn't really find an idea that we were mutually passionate about. So even if you find someone with the same work ethic, it doesn't necessarily work. So it would be really interesting to hear more about how you knew it would kind of work with your co-founder, and I guess if you had any advice for other people who are thinking about getting a co-founder.
Yeah, look, that's a really interesting question. And to be honest, back then, I had no idea whether it would work or not. I had no idea what I was doing. I was in my early 20s. I think I was 23 when we started Pet Rescue. And as I say, it was myself and my partner at the time, Michelle, and Vicky. And it was an idea that Michelle actually came up with. And three of us kind of sat together in a pub and thought, wow, we have really complementary skills that we could use to bring this idea to life. The idea of a website. So we needed somebody that could do the tech stuff and bring the tech side of things to life, which I can do. We needed someone with marketing skills, which was Vicky's, really, really great strength. And we needed someone with the connections to the animal rescue arena and with the administrative kind of skills that binds it all together, which was Michelle's background. And so it just seemed like a natural, really good fit, And so we started it. And Pet Rescue has a really interesting origin story. I mean, we worked on it for the best part of a year before we launched the website. And it was in 2004 we launched, August 2004. And I worked on the website in the evenings, and I'd work on it on the weekends. And, I'm in my early 20s, so I'm going out partying as well, and I'm drinking. So finding the time to, I had a full-time job as an IT manager. I had a consulting business I was running on the side where I'd go to companies around the city in the evenings during the week, and they would give me keys and they would give me a list of IT problems they wanted fixed. So I'd go in there after hours, like some kind of IT fairy, and go and solve all their problems. And they'd come in the next day, all their problems are fixed, they're happy. I was earning some extra pocket money on the side. That was great. So on top of this, I was building the Pet Rescue website. So it was an incredibly hectic time. And I kept up that pace of having three jobs up until probably 5 or 6 years ago. So for, you know, 10 years, I would have a full-time job that was usually quite an intense role as an IT manager or as a, you know, technical consultant, and be doing external consulting for additional clients and be looking after Pet Rescue's technical challenges at the same time. So pretty crazy. But I think what I've learnt in the time since, and, you know, 15 years we've been running Pet Rescue now, and it's a long time, you learn a lot. And for me, I've been really lucky to work with some really amazing mentors and just have great conversations with people along the way. I think three founders working together can work, and it did work for Pet Rescue for a long time. Michelle left the company a few years ago now, but Vicky and I are still kind of co-CEOs of Pet Rescue, and we have a third director, because in Australia, for a non-profit organisation, you need to have at least three members on your board. But our third director, Matt, is more of a silent board member, I guess. We go to him when we need particular skills that he's very, very good at. He's an absolute genius. He's done some incredible things on his own. He now runs a venture capital firm and works for some amazing companies. So we get help from him when we need it. He's such a great man. And really what I'm thinking of now came from a conversation with Matt. And he said to me, of all the companies he's worked with, which has been a lot, he found that the ones that tended to work really well were ones that had two founders or just co-founders, because you need someone to bounce ideas off. You know, you need someone to, you know, sanity check what you're doing and what you're thinking. But sometimes when you're working with three or more founders, it can get a little bit difficult, and maybe there's a conflict there that's harder to resolve. And I think working with two is really good. It can be problematic as well. I mean, certainly there's times when Vicky and I don't agree on something. What we've learned over the years is that that's okay. And we're never going to agree on everything all the time. What we need to do is be able to have a conversation about it, work out, you know, be able to see each other's point of view and come to a place of resolution.
Mm-hmm. Definitely makes sense. I think the most common duo, I suppose, I see like out there starting, I guess, tech-related companies tend to be someone with like an engineer with all the techie background, and also then another person who's got more of like the sales expertise, like the sales and marketing, and those two skill sets really complement each other at the start, especially when you're building kind of the foundations of it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And it's a sad reality that so many technical people lack the ability to interact well with customers, with other team members. Not always. And speaking as a guy with a technical background myself, you know, I get along well with people. I can talk to people of all levels. If I need to go and talk to a CEO of a company, I can. If I then need to walk next door and talk to their head technical person, I can do that. And it's about adjusting the level that you're speaking at and understanding that the CEO doesn't want to know about in-depth technical details. He wants to know about total cost of ownership, or, you know, how this change will influence his bottom line, things like that. Whereas the tech doesn't care about that stuff. He wants to know about cool technical things. So you need to be able to adjust the way you're speaking and what you're speaking about. And unfortunately, a lot of technical people are very, very good technically, and they are absolute masters of their own arenas, but they don't have that ability to, I guess, be receptive to different audiences that they're speaking to.
And it would be also really useful to hear a bit more about Pet Rescue. Like, how does it work? How do you help people? Tell us about the services that you offer.
Cool. So Pet Rescue, as I said, we launched in 2004. And I remember when I was doing all those late nights and the long weekends working on the original website and back in the day. And keeping in mind, this was 2004, which sounds like a long time ago, but 2004 was the year that Facebook launched. It was, you know, kind of pre-social media. There was MySpace, but, you know, people weren't really listing pets for adoption on MySpace. It wasn't really what it was all about. I can't even remember what MySpace was about, to be honest.
I think it's still like around now. That website everybody used, like, yeah, called Bebo as well. Crazy. Yep. So funny.
Absolutely. And then Facebook came along and then, you know, just really rebooted that entire social trend and, you know, became what it is today. I look back sometimes and I think, well, we started Facebook and Pet Rescue about the same time. It'd be nice if I'd started Facebook instead of Pet Rescue, I'd have a lot more money. But then given all the problems that Facebook has these days, maybe yeah, I wouldn't want that responsibility. But so at the time when we looked at Pet Rescue, we thought about the idea. We looked at animal rescue in Australia, and we found that in the vast majority of cases, if you wanted to rescue an animal, you were getting them from a council pound in most cases. And a council pound, you know, they tend to be on cheap land, so they're often near rubbish dumps, you know, waste disposal sites. So to go to these places, you have to drive for a little bit to get there. They're not in convenient, accessible places. They often smell quite bad because they're next to these waste disposal sites and they're full of animals that perhaps aren't getting, the kennels and the pens aren't being maintained as much as they should be. So maybe there's feces or urine there. And these animals, you know, it's really taking an animal and putting it in the most extreme and uncomfortable environment where they've been taken away from their family, taken away from their home, they're put in a concrete pen, there's all these other animals that are scared and barking and, you know, making all this noise. So it's a really, really scary time for an animal. So you're seeing them at their worst. So you walk into these council pounds, it smells bad, it's noisy, there's all these dogs running around and barking, jumping up on the pens. Often what we hear from people is that there's a kind of guilt that you see 10 or 20 or 30 dogs, but you can't take them all with you. So you feel bad that if you only take one, you're leaving the rest, and what's going to happen to them? Are they going to be killed? You know, is anybody else coming to get them? So a really intense and not a very pleasant experience. So that was where a lot of people were getting their rescue pets from. Other than that, you know, there's a few privately run shelters in Australia, but it's not very common. What's more common, particularly now, but also back then when we were starting Pet Rescue, is there are foster care groups that start up because they see what happens to dogs and cats in pounds. They don't like the fact that these animals sometimes go into the pounds and don't come back out again. So they start a small rescue group with their local community and they take the animals out of the pounds and then they advertise them however they can to get them into new permanent homes. So we looked at this and we thought, these little groups are doing amazing things and, you know, they're having a really positive impact in this space, but, you know, they either don't have websites or they have websites nobody's going to, because even now it's hard to start a small website and, you know, get the eyeballs, get the traffic. And, you know, they're putting up posters in their local shopping centre. You know, they're doing these really good and really positive sort of marketing efforts, but they were just so small scale and they weren't getting the reach and the impact that we thought they deserve. So off the back of that, we thought, right, let's start Pet Rescue. Let's build a website. They can advertise the pets they have for adoption on Pet Rescue, and then hopefully we can start to drive traffic to Pet Rescue and sort of cover the supply and the demand end of the site. So we looked at what was around, and in the US, there's a website called Pet Finder. Pet Finder's been around, I think, for 25 years now. It's a website that's been around for a long time. And we looked at Pet Finder and we thought, this is pretty cool. We could pick little bits of Pet Finder and use those, and we'll throw in a few ideas we had ourselves. And there wasn't much else around in the world at that time. So we took that, we built Pet Rescue. And I remember thinking when I was doing all this work on evenings and weekends, thinking that if all this effort means that one dog doesn't end up being killed in a council pound, then that's perfect. You know, it's worth all the effort that I put in, the three of us have put in. And we launched the site in 2004. We immediately had people start listing pets on the site. We immediately got some media attention, some newspaper articles and some radio spots promoting Pet Rescue. And I think in the first year, we launched in August 2004, we rehomed over 500 pets in that first year. And that was amazing to see this happening. Yeah, it was a really incredibly positive experience to start making a little bit of an impact. And really, we've evolved a lot over the years, and we do a huge amount of other things, but really that core function of being an advertising platform for rescue pets hasn't changed. So we still do the same thing today that we started doing in 2004. We started just with dogs on Pet Rescue and immediately got a lot of requests from people that had cats that needed new homes. And so we gave them the opportunity to list cats on Pet Rescue. We now allow pretty much any animal you can think of. So we've had, you know, ponies and chickens and turkeys and all manner of creatures. One hermit crab has been rehomed by Pet Rescue. And yeah, so you know, now we see around about 80,000 pets per year rehomed via Pet Rescue. And yeah, a huge part of this is the rescue groups themselves, because they're the ones that are actually caring for the pets. They're the ones that are taking them either as surrenders from the public or taking them from council pounds or wherever these animals are coming from to find their way into the rescue system. They're the ones doing the, you know, the hard work and actually caring for them, getting them vet work, whatever they need. And then they list them on Pet Rescue, and we do whatever we can to get eyeballs on the Pet Rescue website and get people looking at these pets and inquiring and adopting them. So
wow, I think that's amazing.
Yeah. Thank you. It's nice to have made a difference.
It's such a lovely story of how tech has helped solve a problem, because I think all too often these days, especially at the moment, we hear such like negative side effects of like tech, and tech is bad, and look at what's happening in the world, like social media and stuff. But actually, like, this is a really nice example of where tech has actually saved a lot of animals' lives and brought a lot of joy to people's lives by having this new animal. And these foster groups that had basically solved the problem, but they just didn't have the scale or the skills or the reach to be able to scale the solution to be more widespread. And I guess with this kind of tech, your reach is huge, because it doesn't need to be confined to just one area. It can be all across Australia, and you know, that could fit other places, like other countries as well, that kind of model.
Yeah, look, exactly right. In fact, we've been talking for a little while now about bringing Pet Rescue to the UK. We've got a friend of ours. Yeah. And I mean, I think it's a really great idea. I'd love to see that happen. It's a really good point that, you know, tech used well can be a huge game changer. And you're right, we do hear a lot at the moment about how social media is ruining lives, and, you know, horrible videos being posted on YouTube, and, you know, technology bringing hate groups together and things like that. But it's easy to overlook all of the positive ways that technology has helped. Even being able to, you know, have a video conference and record a podcast like this. You're in London, I'm in Perth. You know, my internet connection is not even very good, and this works great. You know?
Yeah.
But I think it's a really interesting point that, coming back to entrepreneurship and trying to work out what it is that you want to do and what you want to build and how you want to help. It's finding a problem, but it's also recognizing that your particular way to help or to try and fix that problem or to make it a little bit better might be different to what other people are doing. I mean, it would have been easy, maybe not easy, but it would have been an alternate option for us back in 2004 to start a rescue group or to, you know, buy some land and build a shelter. But that wasn't the skill sets that we had. We had the skill sets of tech and marketing and relationship building. And we looked at those and thought, okay, well, those are the skills that we have. How can we use those to really try and impact this problem and make a difference? And by doing that, I mean, from day one, we designed Pet Rescue to be kind of a hands-off platform. So, you know, we designed it so that people could log in, list pets, inquire about pets, manage their listings, do all of that stuff without any involvement from the three founders. And that meant that, you know, over the years, particularly in the earlier days when Pet Rescue was, you know, a website, a platform, and not too much more. I mean, now we're a lot more. We do a huge amount of things other than the website. We have 15 staff, about half of those are part-time. But yeah, back in the day, there was three of us working on Pet Rescue in our spare time. And so it was really important that the platform could kind of run itself and we could be hands-off and not touch it for a week and everything would keep working. People could keep listing pets and inquiring about pets and rehoming pets and adopting pets. And that was, you know, really, really important. So yeah, it's always, I think it's, you know, identifying the problem and just looking at how you can bring your unique skill set to bear to kind of really make a difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And it would also be interesting to hear your perspectives on like running a not-for-profit, because I have a friend who is really passionate about, like, she has all these business ideas, but she keeps coming back to business ideas to help the problem of homelessness. But she's just so concerned about how, you know, how do I live if I start a company that's a not-for-profit. So it would be really interesting to hear your perspectives on that.
Yeah, for sure. I've got a whole bunch of thoughts. So I think the first thing that's really important for everyone to understand, and a lot of people don't get this about charities, and it's quite interesting, is, you know, running a not-for-profit or we start a not-for-profit, that doesn't mean you don't get paid. I mean, I get paid. I get paid a reasonable wage. I could certainly get paid a lot more in the private sector, but I get paid a wage that's comfortable for me. It hasn't always been that way. For the first, you know, 10 years of Pet Rescue, I didn't get paid. In fact, I put, you know, tens of thousands of dollars into Pet Rescue. But that's what was needed for Pet Rescue to operate. So I believed in the project, in the company, and what we were doing, and I felt that was worthwhile. Really, from day one, when Pet Rescue started having some money and started paying myself and the other two founders, and then when we started having a few staff, we operated Pet Rescue like any other company. So we didn't scrimp and save in areas that would negatively impact the business. You know, if we were trying to hire someone, say we were hiring someone to do digital marketing for us, we would go out and we'd go, right, what do we pay a digital marketer, junior level digital marketer? They get paid, maybe $60,000, $65,000, something like that. Okay, that's what we need to budget for that role. And we wouldn't say, okay, they're worth $65,000, but we're a charity, so we'll pay $45,000. Because if you do that, you're going to end up with someone that's either, I mean, you may well end up with someone that's very passionate about the cause and will do a very good job. But I think there's great risk of finding someone that's not that great. And for us, it was really important to not just pay people what they're worth, but to get the best people that we could. And I'd rather have three staff that were amazing than five staff that were kind of all a bit average. You know, and we've done that since day one, and it's worked really well for us. We've had some amazing people working for Pet Rescue over the last, you know, 5-6 years, and we have an incredible team now. So, yeah, running a not-for-profit, working for a not-for-profit doesn't mean that you should suffer And the chap that I'm thinking of, he makes a really compelling argument that not-for-profits should have the most money and they should be able to pay the best wages because, you know, one of, you know, pick a large mining company for us. I'm thinking locally, say BHP, which is a large mining operation in Australia. Nothing against BHP, they're a great company. I've got no issue with them at all. But say they could hire a chief financial officer. So a CFO working for BHP, maybe they get paid $500,000 a year. That's a guess. I'm not really sure, but it'd be something like that. If we were to hire someone like that, we'd struggle to pay them a fifth of that. But which company is more deserving of the most talented person? I'd argue that the companies that are doing good for the world probably should have the best people, but it's never going to work that way because, you know, if you had the choice of working for $100,000 or working for $500,000 a year, then obviously you're going to take the bigger money. And fair enough, I'd probably do the same thing if I hadn't started the charity. You kind of hit this a little bit of a weird problem where, you know, charities unfortunately can't afford the best people, but you can certainly afford, actually that's not even right, you can afford some absolutely amazing people, but I feel like the whole sector is a little bit upside down. You know, by default, not-for-profits and charities should be paying the best money to get the best people, and it's just never going to be that way. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's a really interesting problem.
Yeah, it sounds like an interesting debate, definitely. And I think with that, it's sometimes people think of money as such a dirty word as well, but I think it's probably something to do with money mindset and seeing it more as a vehicle for like return on investment. So like you were saying, if you hired someone that was cheap and wasn't necessarily very good, maybe their work would help you bring on like an additional 500 rehomes, for example. But if you hired someone that was really good and paid them like a bit more, maybe they would help you rehome like 20,000. So it's better off you paying a bit more to get that return on investment. And also, I guess if you really think about your company as well, like if you didn't pay any of you, how are you going to live? There's no way that you could do that kind of work. So you're better off paying some money to you, creating this company and, you know, solving this problem, saving some animals' lives rather than just not having the company at all, you know?
Look, absolutely right. And as well, you know, if we've got a bunch of staff, I want to be able to comfortably look at that group of people and say, we pay these people a reasonable market wage to do their job. We're not shortchanging them. We're not doing the wrong thing by them. We're looking after them well. We're giving them what they need to survive and be comfortable. And that's really important to me. It's really strange. The charity sector is a really interesting place to find yourself, or certainly an interesting place for me to find myself. I was actually watching a short documentary last night with my partner, and it's about this amazing guy. He's a biomedical chap. He's based out of Sydney. And he works, or he does a whole bunch of stuff involving using signals from the brain, from the mind, to control things. And in this documentary, he's working with a 13-year-old boy who has cerebral palsy, building a really clever and really unique and innovative interface so that this boy, I wish I could remember his name, but so he can use eye tracking to drive a car. So this amazing 13-year-old boy, he's a really smart guy. He can't speak. He suffers with severe cerebral palsy. And this amazing doctor works with him to build this customized car that he can drive with eye movements. It's absolutely incredible. But I was watching this with my partner Mel, and in the movie, the doctor, he's driving around in his Tesla and he's going to his cool kind of lab that's all decked out with these cool toys. And I was saying, it's really interesting that he's doing great work, and I wouldn't say a bad word about him. I think he's an absolute, absolutely amazing man. Actually, I'd love to meet him and spend some time with him. He's an incredible chap. But in this doco, he's kind of shown as having lots of money, a really nice car, a really nice workspace he works out of, and he runs a for-profit company and does some work like this as part of that. And I'm like, that's incredible. If he was running a not-for-profit and everything else was the same, he's driving a nice car, he's got a really nice workspace, a lot of people would be up in arms about that, because there's this notion that to work in the not-for-profit space, in the charity sector, you have to be struggling. You know, you have to be struggling. You have to be poverty-stricken. And if you're showing signs of success, that's somehow deemed a negative, or that you're taking advantage. And this is an idea I really struggle with, because I think if you can take a charity and build it up into a successful company and have enough money to hire an appropriate amount of staff and pay them market wages, then you've achieved as much, if not more, than somebody operating a for-profit company. Because, you know, for me, as a co-founder of Pet Rescue, I can pay myself a reasonable wage, but I'm never going to walk away with a $100,000 bonus at the end of the year. I can't sell Pet Rescue for $1 million to another company. I don't have those options. Not that I want that, but if I'd started a for-profit company, those are all options that I have. Well, maybe my company's just really successful and I pay myself a whole bunch of money every year. So I think as a non-profit, you're constrained in all these ways, yet to, you know, despite that, you succeed and have a really successful business. There are people out there that are uncomfortable with that and don't like
it. Yeah, that is fascinating. And I guess
it's a really interesting space.
What value do you put on fulfillment, I suppose, because working for a not-for-profit, the fulfillment that you could get for actually contributing to the world is huge. So I guess it's kind of that opportunity cost of extra money versus extra fulfillment, you know?
Look, it's exactly right. And it's part of, you know, for me, I've never sat well with being a cog in a corporate machine. I've done it. I've worked for banks. I've worked for insurance companies in mining, marketing, advertising, medical. I've had a bunch of different jobs in all those spaces, and I've done very well in all of those roles, but I've never really felt comfortable. Whereas being able to more or less be my own boss and set the direction for the company, that sits really well for me. So, and yeah, like I say, back in that first year of Pet Rescue back in 2004, we rehomed over 500 pets. That was incredible. And, you know, now in 2019, we've helped it's somewhere over 550,000 pets anyway, find new homes. And we're working with over 1,000 rescue groups around the country. We're looking at potentially in the future working, bringing Pet Rescue to other countries and helping even more pets find new homes. So that's pretty profound. And even, you know, from my technical point of view, we run a very high traffic website. Pet Rescue has over 25,000 unique visitors per day to the platform. And that puts us up there in terms of websites. You know, we're the most trafficked charity website in Australia. And when you look at organisations like World Vision, Red Cross, these organisations that have hundreds upon hundreds of paid staff, they have, you know, tens of millions of dollars in donation revenue a year. We're a very modest little organisation with 15 staff, and our turnover is about $1.3, $1.4 million a year. So we're very, very small by comparison, but we're doing really big things. So it's quite exciting.
Yeah, definitely. Really exciting. I hope that's kind of debunked a few myths for some of our listeners about working for a charity. And it definitely has for me as well. Okay, but let's move on to kind of well-being then. So as a founder, burnout and stress can kind of be real everyday things that you've got to deal with. And I know, JB, that you wrote that really amazing Medium article that I've enjoyed reading, and I've shared it like lots of times because I think it's so useful. So for the listeners, JB wrote this article. It was mainly around men and yoga, but kind of had more details about kind of well-being and mental health and things like that. So it would be really useful to hear from you, maybe more perspectives and some of those perspectives that you shared in the article. About like mental health and happiness and how you found yoga. And I just think it's always useful to hear a men's perspective as well, because I spoke to Stefan about this yesterday, and men often don't kind of communicate their feelings as much as women do. So sometimes men sort of suffer in silence. So it would just be really interesting to hear your perspectives on that and maybe how yoga helped as well.
Yeah, sure. It's really interesting. As I mentioned earlier, for the majority of my working life, I've had three jobs, and I've worked three jobs concurrently. So my full-time kind of, keep the lights on sort of job, my consulting job, which has been a number of different companies over the years, or just me working on my own doing consulting for companies, and also Pet Rescue. So it's only been in the last probably 3 or 4 years, I guess, I've dialed that back a little bit, but that's, I'm still now my full-time job is Pet Rescue, but I still do consulting as well. And now I teach yoga as well. So I guess maybe it hasn't changed that much. I've had some really great opportunities to learn about health and well-being in my life. I've for a long time, I think to help cope with the amount of work stress I had going on, I drank too much. And I know Australians have a pretty amazing reputation for drinking too much. I never thought that I had a problem, but I definitely did. I remember a friend of mine's girlfriend at the time, now his wife, saying to me, I said to her, I thought maybe if I'm not careful, one day there's a risk that maybe I could become an alcoholic. And she said to me, JB, you are an alcoholic. I'm like, what do you mean? And she said, when was the last night you didn't have a drink? And I thought about it and I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember the last day, really, I'd gone without drinking. And it wasn't heaps, but it might be a few beers of an evening. But then Thursday, Friday night, it was a few more beers, and Saturday, Sunday, it was a heap of beers. And and I took a bunch of drugs when I was younger as well. So it's kind of party lifestyle, and I smoked on and off, and I didn't really look after myself very well. I think there's a lot of reasons why that happened. Stress was part of it. I think part of it was just fun. It was cultural. It was what we did. But it certainly wasn't good for me. And so learning that you can live and thrive without drinking heaps all the time, certainly without taking drugs, without smoking, and you can actually feel really great. Now, I do drink. Occasionally, I might drink maybe once a week, maybe once a fortnight, but I'll have one or two beers and then I'll stop. And if I have any more than that, I have the opportunity to realize how bad I feel when I do it and how negatively it affects me. And it's quite profound. Once you get used to kind of a healthy sober baseline and you have a few drinks, you're like, man, I feel really crappy. Like, this is horrible. And I think as well, as you said, men, generally speaking, can struggle to talk about feelings and talk about what's going on in their minds. And I was lucky. I've been married once. I'm engaged again. I'm getting married in November, which I'm excited about.
Congrats.
thank you. But my first marriage, it didn't work out so well, and there was a lot of drinking and a lot of disagreements. One of the really positive things that came out of that was I did a heap of counselling. So I worked with a counsellor in one-on-one sessions, and I also did some couples counselling with my ex, with a really great psych, well, two really great psychologists, and that was really profound. And I think it's had a really big impact on who I am now and how I handle my relationships and how I kind of go about my life. And I know that there's a lot of men that would never even consider talking to a counsellor, which I think is really, really disappointing. And I encourage people whenever I speak to anyone, not just men, but, you know, usually men, that will open up and say maybe things aren't so great at home with their partner, or maybe they're struggling at work, or maybe with a substance abuse problem, to go on and talk to a counsellor. And it can be, yeah, really confronting for a lot of men. So it's really interesting. It's something I really advocate for and will encourage people. And I think it helps as well to talk about it. You know, I'm very open. I'm like, hey, I had some problems in my past, you know, nothing bad. You know, I'm sure a lot of people have suffered a lot more than I had, but I had things that I couldn't fix. And for men, I try and it's an old IT trick. When you're talking to people about what's wrong with their computer, you kind of compare it to a similar problem that they might have with their car, because, you know, generally speaking, men understand cars. They get car analogies. And I do the same with kind of mental health and say to people, look, you know, it's maybe if you're feeling a little bit down, a little bit flat, and you don't know what to do, maybe that's the equivalent of, you know, you need to check the tire pressure in your car. So maybe that's something you can sort out on your own. Or maybe you can ask your mate over a few beers and talk it out. And, you know, it's okay. But, you know, when it's a big problem, when your car, when it started, or it's making really bad noise, or the gearbox is broken, then you take it to a mechanic, you take it to an expert. And, you know, the analogy there is when you've got a real problem, when you're really struggling and you know, maybe a bit depressed, or, you know, you just can't get past whatever barrier you have in your life, go and talk to a professional. Go and seek some help, because it's so, so valuable. And, yeah, so mental health, it's a real struggle. And it kind of plays into my work at Pet Rescue as well, because so many people in the rescue community, people that we work with, they work very, very hard. And often they have a full-time job. They're doing animal welfare, animal rescue in the spare time. Burnout is a real problem. Self-care or lack thereof is a real problem. And this is something that we're really actively trying to promote at the moment, is thinking about self-care, thinking about your well-being, thinking about compassion fatigue. And in fact, just today, I got a note back from a good friend of mine who organises Australia's really our only conference that happens every 2 years for this sector. And it's happening again in September, I think, this year. And I wrote to her and I said, look, Pet Rescue wants to be involved. We've had a few ideas. And one of the things I'd like to do is run a yoga class during the conference. It's over 3 days. How about one morning I run a yoga class, and one morning we'll organise a group beach walk. The conference is in Surfers Paradise in Queensland, and wow, it's right near a beach. Yeah, yeah.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah, it is pretty great. As long as schoolies week isn't on. I'm like, yeah, we'll do a group walk on the beach. We'll talk about some self-care tips, because, you know, we've worked with an organisational psychologist at Pet Rescue. We've worked with a compassion fatigue specialist. You know, we've done a lot of work on this, so we know a few tips and tricks that we can share with people. And we're even going to do a 5-minute meditation in between sessions during the conference. So, you know, sharing some of these self-care techniques with people, I hope will help. And just, even if it just sparks a little bit of interest in people to try and do some yoga or do some meditation or go for a walk, you know, it's super important. And so, yeah, coming full circle back to yoga for me, as you mentioned in the intro, I just finished our yoga teacher training earlier this year. One of the things I'm super excited about is doing yoga for men, because for a few reasons. I mean, men, generally speaking, tend to be less flexible and more kind of physically constrained than women. But also I think men are, certainly speaking from my own experience, I was scared to go to a yoga class. And I started doing yoga probably about 18 months, 2 years ago. So I haven't been doing yoga consistently for very long. But I remember being really scared, and my partner Mel gently kind of forced me along to a yin class or a restorative class, I can't remember, at her local studio in Sydney at the time. And I went along, and there's all these women there, and they're all bendy, and I'm all, you know, kind of uptight, and I can't move at all. And it was really, yeah, I walked out of there the first time thinking, everyone's looking at me. Everyone's judging me. I'm no good. Everyone's better than me. And it took me probably two or three classes before I realized that they were, you know, the people that were there were really happy to see me there. They were so happy that there was a guy doing yoga. And
definitely.
Yeah, and as I'm sure you know, when you're doing yoga, you're not looking at anyone else. All you're thinking about is, have I got this pose down? Is my, you know, angle underneath my knee? Am I hyperextending somewhere I shouldn't be? How's my alignment? How long are we going to have to hold this pose for? I'm going to collapse. My balance is bad. You know, you're thinking about all these things. Or maybe you're completely zen in a nice yin pose. But by the way, you're not worrying about the person next to you, the person behind you. You're in your own little space. And once you realize that, yoga can become this really magical thing that, you know, it brings so much physical well-being and benefits, but also the mental well-being is really profound. And, you know, that article that you mentioned, the thing that I was really, well, one of the main sort of points I was trying to make in that article is that if you're a team leader or a manager or a CEO or, you know, a leader of people in any context, even a parent, you know, really anybody that takes on those responsibilities, it's hard. It's really difficult to be in that role. And to go into a yoga class for an hour, to switch your phone off, to take your smartwatch off, you know, to really get rid of all those bits of distracting technology that want your attention every 5 minutes, and go into the class and surrender to the teacher, and really, you know, you stop being the boss then, and the teacher becomes the boss, and you're just the student. Not just the student, but you're the student. You know, you're there to learn and to follow. You can relax and not need to lead for an hour. And I find that absolutely incredible and so valuable, to be able to go into that environment, just let go of all the responsibility and all the leadership that's part of my day, and just relax and do some yoga for an hour and walk out feeling like a new person.
Yeah, definitely. I can totally relate. No, thanks, JB, for being so honest there. I think you know, provided some really interesting insights that I think a lot of people can relate to as well.
I hope so. Yeah.
Okay, so I know we're coming up to time. I've decided to do this little thing called a quick fire round. So awesome. I've got three quick questions that I'm going to ask you, if that's all right.
For sure.
Okay, so first one, what is the best book you've ever read?
I've just finished reading it. It is Rich Roll's book. And I think it's called Born to Run, maybe? Or no, it's Finding Ultra. Finding Ultra, I think. But Rich Roll's book, anyway, it's absolutely life-changing.
What is it kind of about it, if you could summarize?
Yeah, he was in his early 40s. He had suffered with alcoholism. He'd suffered with drug abuse. And he had done some work and got past that, but he was still eating too much, eating junk food. He was overweight. He was starting to physically suffer to walk upstairs and things like that. He moved to a vegetarian diet and then realized that wasn't enough for him. So he switched to a whole food plant-based diet, which is what I eat as well. And I heartily recommend for anyone anywhere. Get off the meat, get off the dairy, and go whole food plant-based. You will never feel as good. It's the best diet I can possibly imagine. So he switched to this amazing vegan diet and then ran an Ultraman event, which is basically two Ironman-level triathlons back-to-back.
Well,
And it's all about his journey, about, you know, becoming, I think it says on the cover, becoming one of the world's fittest men. So he's now in his early 50s. He is ultra fit. He runs these crazy long distance marathons and triathlons. And the book's all about his journey and how, you know, he's just an ordinary guy that took on these incredible challenges and did some incredible things. It's, you know, amazing, absolutely amazing, Brie.
That's so cool. I love that. I'll have to add that to my list. Okay, second question. So this is the Well and Wild podcast. So with that said, what is the wildest thing you've ever done?
I think probably taking the plunge and starting a business. And I've started a few of them now. Pet Rescue is definitely the most successful, but I started a web hosting company. I've started a couple of consulting businesses. I started a record label with a friend of mine.
No way. That's so cool.
Yeah. It was pretty awesome, actually. Unfortunately, a terrible way to make any money, but a lot of fun. And as I was talking to you just before we started recording, potentially opening a yoga studio. That's the next plunge. And I think having the confidence to just kind of say, yeah, fuck it, take the plunge, give it a go. It might work, it might not.
I love
that. But you've got to try. And if it doesn't work out, you're not failing. It's just a learning opportunity. But if you never try, and you just do the same job for your whole life, man, I couldn't do it. Like, it's
so
you're never going to change your life that way.
So true. And finally, what's the best piece of advice that you've ever been given?
Gosh, that's a really good one. There's a quote by Stephen King that I can't quite remember, and it was him quoting somebody else. But it kind of boiled down to don't look back, whether it's in business. I think the quote was specifically around, you know, don't look over your shoulder at your competitors to see if they're nipping at your heels. There's no point. Just keep looking forward, keep doing what you're doing, keep innovating and growing and doing new things. And I think that applies to most things in life as well. Don't dwell on the past. Learn from the past, but don't dwell on it. Don't have regrets. Don't carry that baggage around with you. Just look forward and think about the next thing and what you can do, how you can grow, and what you can achieve.
That is such an important message. I love that. So thanks, JB. So where can the listeners find you? I can put this in the show notes as well, but just your Instagram.
So Instagram, my personal account is PetJB, P-E-T-J-B.
Yeah.
Which is also Twitter and also Facebook. I'm not very active on Facebook, but occasionally on Twitter. And lots of absolutely ridiculous things about my life on Instagram. I'm also Yoga by JB on Instagram.
Yep.
And I'm on Medium as well, occasionally publish a few things there.
Amazing. Yeah, I'm going to share the link to your article as well, because I think it's really good and worth a read. But thank you so much for coming on. I've really enjoyed it. I hope you have as well. And I know the listeners will get so much value from everything that you've spoken about. It's been great.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really enjoyed it.
So there we are, episode 3 of the Well and Wild podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. I really thought the conversation was super interesting. I loved some of the discussions that we had, especially around the not-for-profit sector and things like that. There were a lot of things that I didn't kind of necessarily realize, or I think that I hadn't even considered before. And I think the TED talk, I've actually checked it out and I've linked it in the show notes, and it's really, really, really interesting on charity sector pay, so I'd definitely suggest to check that out. But if you enjoyed the episode, please can you send it on to one friend who you think might find the content really interesting and useful. I'd be really, really appreciative of that. And thank you for listening, and have an amazing week.